As the bus full of women inched and squealed its slow way through Tehran traffic towards the Ayatollah Khomeini's home, I was the only one aboard who wasn't weeping. We eased to a stop beside a black-bannered alley. The keening gained pitch, like a whistling kettle reaching the boil. At the end of the alley was Khomeini's house and the small adjoining Hassaniya, where he'd prayed and preached until just before his death 5 weeks earlier. Drenched with sweat and trying not to trip on my chador, I filed off the bus and joined the tight black phalanx, moving its way down the alley with sobbing chants of, "Oh, Khomeini! Oh, Imam!" Our group turned aside from the Hassaniya to a curtained entrance flanked by female revolutionary guards. Under their chadors, the big black squares of fabric tossed over the head and falling to the ankles, the guards wore the same olive-drab uniform with its emblem of a rifle, Quran, and clenched fist as their male counterparts. Behind the curtain, Khomeini's widow waited to serve us tea. When she held my hand and patted it gently, her chador slid backward to reveal a half inch of silver roots topped by a tumble of carrot-coloured curls. Until her husband's death, Khadija had dyed her hair. Somehow, I'd never imagined that the stony-faced Ayatollah had a wife, certainly not one with vamp-red hair. And I hadn't pictured him with the cute, giggling great-grandchildren who romped around us in the carpet-strewn courtyard. I know that when you saw him, he looked very serious, even angry, said Zahra Mustafavi, Khomeini's 47-year-old daughter. But he wasn't like that with us. With children, he made so many jokes. He used to let us hide under his robes when we were playing hide-and-seek. According to Zahra, Khomeini had been quite the sensitive new-age man, getting up in the night when his 5 children were infants to take turns giving them their bottles, and never asking his wife to do anything for him. Khadija had been his only wife. Her public profile had been so low that most Iranians didn't even know her real name. Despite her public anonymity, insiders knew that her influence counted. Men who wanted Khomeini's ear, even on matters of state policy, would have their wives raise the issue with Khadija. The call to sunset prayer, wafting over the courtyard wall from a nearby mosque, was our signal that the tea party was over. In the corner, Khadija was already on her feet, on her way to wash for prayers. As we filed back into the bus, which nosed back through the traffic, a Hezbollah woman was still declaiming, "We have to divide our lives into 2 parts, before and after the Imam's death," she sobbed. "We haven't yet had time to understand the loss we've suffered." I, for one, hadn't had time to understand it. Before Khomeini's death, I'd been allowed into Iran only once, in 1988, to cover the funerals of the 290 Iranian civilians killed when the cruiser USSS Visenz shot down an Iranian Airbus on a scheduled civilian flight across the Persian Gulf. But I needed to understand. What was happening to Muslim women from Algeria to Afghanistan had its roots here, in that austere, boxy house in North Tehran. Somehow, Khomeini had persuaded women that the wearing of a medieval cloak was a revolutionary act. Something in his message had brought thousands of women into the streets to face the Shah's army and risk their lives calling for the return of a code of laws that allowed child marriage, polygamy, and wife-beating. When Khomeini died in June of 1989, Iran opened its doors to any journalist who showed up. After the frantic funeral, President Hashemi Rafsanjani held a rare press conference for the foreign reporters. I went, wearing a black chador. Because such events are always televised in Iran, I knew that the press conference organizers wouldn't let me near a microphone with so much as a hair showing. But when I finally got to put my question about the shape of the post-Khomeini power structure, Rafsanjani gazed at me, a hint of a smile playing on his moon-shaped face. "I have a question for you," he said. "Why do you wear that heavy veil when a simple scarf would do?" "I'm wearing it," I said, in a spirit of mutual respect. Ruffs and Johnny looked taken aback. The two other Western women reporters at the press conference rolled their eyes. But to one or two people, what I had said did matter. A few days later, Khomeini's daughter Zahra invited me to a conference sponsored by the Women's Society of the Islamic Republic of Iran, titled Aspect of His Highness Imam Khomeini's Personality. I studied the title with bemusement. The only aspects of His Highness Imam Khomeini's personality I was familiar with were his penchant for condemning novelists to death, dispatching young boys to the war front as human minesweepers, and permitting little girls to be married off at the age of 9. The venue for the conference was Tehran's Revolutionary Hotel, a pre-revolutionary glass-walled elevator designed to give a view of the swimming pool had been newspapered over for the duration of the conference so that religious women wouldn't be offended by the sight of glistening male torsos. Since the revolution, only men are allowed to swim in public. It took about 5 minutes at the first evening's ice-breaking cocktail party, fruit juice cocktails only, no un-Islamic alcohol, to realize that I was the odd woman out amid a female who's who of Iran's exported revolution. The delegates from Lebanon included the wives of the men most often named as heads of the hostage takers there. There were, as well, Muslim militants from Pakistan, Sudan, Guinea, Tanzania, India, and South Africa. It was a group with a lot of enemies, and the hotel was surrounded by a cordon of armed revolutionary guards. No one went in or out without permission. The party dress code was basic black. Layers of it. Chadors were only the finishing touches, over long pants, socks, calf-length tunics, and hoods called magnes, a circle of fabric like a nun's wimple that falls over head and shoulders, leaving just a hole for the face. As the black cloak figures milled around me, I began to feel I'd been locked up by mistake in some kind of convent from hell. A South African student from the University of Cape Town kept glancing uncomfortably at her Islamic sister from Guinea. This tall, stately woman would have stood out in any crowd, but in this one she was particularly eye-catching. Instead of shapeless black, she wore a length of lilac fabric wrapped closely around her sinuous curves. An end of the fabric draped loosely over her head, leaving most of one smooth, coppery shoulder bare. Naked toes peep from under the hem of her lovely robe. Over the next few days, I would notice one or another of the Islamic sisters standing on tippy-toe, trying to tug the robe up over that shoulder or to wrap the endpiece more closely around her hair. Ghanaians and Iranians clearly had a different definition of hijab. The word hijab literally means curtain, and it is used in the Quran as an instruction to believers of Muhammad's day on how they should deal with the Prophet's wives. If you ask his wives for anything, speak to them from behind a curtain. This is purer for your hearts and their hearts. The revelation on hijab came to Muhammad on one of his wedding nights, just as he was about to bed Zainab, the most controversial of his brides. Islamic scholars generally agree that the marriage to Zainab caused the most serious of several scandals surrounding the Prophet's ever-growing number of wives. Visiting the house of his adopted son, Muhammad had glimpsed the young man's wife only partially dressed. The woman was beautiful, and Muhammad quickly turned away, muttering a prayer against temptation. Believing Muhammad desired his wife, the young man divorced her. Muhammad's subsequent marriage to Zainab provoked uproar in the community, since it violated the rules of incest already set down in the Quran. The uproar subsided only when Muhammad had a new revelation, proclaiming that adoptions were invalid and that those who cared for others' children must proclaim their true parentage. This exempted him from the rule that barred a father from marrying the wife of his son. The revelation of hijab put the Prophet's wives, including Zainab, into seclusion, where they would be safer from scandal. The Quran's instructions for women outside the Prophet's household weren't as severe. Tell the believing women to lower their gaze and be modest, and to display of their adornment only that which is apparent, and to draw their veils over their bosoms. In Cairo, when my assistant Saha began wearing hijab, I dug out this quote and argued with her that it made no reference at all to covering hair. What it seemed to me to be asking was that women conform to conservative norms of dress. In our day, to shun see-through blouses and skimpy miniskirts. But Saha replied that it was necessary to go beyond the Quran for guidance on such matters. She said that the sunnah, the trodden path of Muhammad, those things which he had said, done, or permitted to be done in his presence, made it clear that that which is apparent meant only a woman's face and hands. But Saha's interpretation wasn't universal. Some Muslim women believed, as I did, that religion only required them to dress within contemporary limits of modesty. Others insisted on going beyond a covered head to gloved hands and veiled faces, arguing that the corruption of the modern world made more extreme measures necessary now than in the Prophet's day. Hijab was the most obvious sign of the Islamic revival that had swept up Saha and so many other young women. It began in 1967, after Egypt's catastrophic loss to Israel in the Six-Day War. To explain the humiliation, Muslim philosophers pointed to the secularism of Gamal Abdel Nasser's government and urged Egyptians to return to the Islamic laws they had abandoned. Slowly, the number of veiled women began to increase. But the real surge came with Iran's theocratic revolution, when donning hijab became a political as well as a religious act. In 1935, the Shah's father had banned the chador. Reza Shah wanted his country to look modern, and he thought the ancient black cloak didn't. But devout women, especially the elderly, couldn't make so drastic a change. Some families withdrew their girls from school because they wouldn't see them go out without a covering. As revolutionary pressure mounted in the 1970s, wearing the chador became a symbol of protest against the Shah and his Western backers. Some clerics advocated it for predictable reasons. If all women wore it, reasoned the Iranian cleric Ibrahim Amini, wives could rest assured that their husband, when not at home, would not encounter a lewd woman who might draw his attention away. In Britain, the Muslim scholar Shabir Akhtar came up with an alternative rationale. The aim of the veil, he wrote, is to create a truly erotic culture in which one dispenses with the need for artificial excitement that pornography provides. In both cases, women are expected to sacrifice their comfort and freedom to service the requirements of male sexuality, either to repress or to stimulate the male sex urge. At first, I had naively assumed that hijab would at least free women from the tyranny of the beauty industry. But at the Iranian Women's Conference, locked up day and night with a hotel full of Muslim radicals, I soon learned I'd been mistaken. I asked my Iranian interpreter, Hamideh Marifat, to arrange a meeting for me with the women of Lebanon's Hezbollah. The group's strongholds were the Bekaa Valley and Beirut's southern suburbs, no-go areas for Western journalists since the kidnapping of the Associated Press bureau chief Terry Anderson. I wanted to ask about Anderson, who was spending his days chained to a radiator in a lightless Beirut basement. To meet the women said to be married to his captors seemed like the best chance I'd ever have to get information for his desperate family. In the end, I learned nothing about his plight, but meeting the women was instructive in other ways. They invited me to join them that evening for tea in their suite, provided that I promised not to name them in any articles I wrote. When the door opened to my knock, I thought I had the wrong room. The woman in front of me had frosted blonde hair streaming to her waist. She wore a silk negligee with a deep plunge neckline. On the bed behind her, another woman lay languidly in a bust-hugging, slit-sided scarlet satin nightgown. Through the flimsy fabrics, it was obvious that their bodies were completely hairless, like Barbie dolls. It was, they explained, sunnat, or Islamically recommended, for married women to remove all body hair every 20 days. It took a few minutes to recognize the bleached blonde as the same woman who had wailed the emotional eulogy at the Khomeini house. When I mentioned my surprise at the way she looked, she laughed. "This is how we are at home," she said. striking a seductive pose. Islam encourages us to be beautiful for our husbands. I suddenly understood why Khadija, Khomeini's widow, had hennaed her hair to carrot orange, and why an inch of grey had grown in since she stopped doing it on her husband's death.